Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, breaking news out of Capitol Hill. The number of members who choose not to run increases. Also, more breaking news. The president has waffled on his super PAC ideals. And more breaking news. The Supreme Court decision on religious organizations and Obamacare. How is that going to affect Obamacare in the future? Also, the situation in the Middle East continues to become more tense. Is Israel ready to move on Iran's nuclear capabilities? How long can President Assad of Syria continue to hold power? And are we in the beginning of a de facto war with Russia as a result of the recent UN Security Council vote? In American politics, can Mitt continue the surge from Florida and Nevada with three states holding caucuses today? Can Newt hang on until Super Tuesday? Is the Super Bowl ad with Clint Eastwood an endorsement or just a great message? This and Tell Me a Story Today on Backroom Politics. Here in Washington, D.C., it is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's a light crowd here at Shelley's Back Room at the Political Roundtable. Joining me to my 12 o'clock is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He's a former vice president of government affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Always glad to be here, Justin.
To my right, he is the former longtime Senate staffer up on the Hill. He is the former Undersecretary of Commerce and has served, what's the latest count, four presidents? Give or take?
Three or four.
We lost count after three. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, welcome.
Nice to be back.
We are missing. Congressman Al is enjoying actually a month off. We hope you're having fun at your little tropical retreat, Congressman Al. And Dr. Ralph Winnie is away on business, not even able to call in, which is odd. But we've got a lot to cover today. There is just a bunch of news coming out of Washington, D.C. today. First one, breaking news. The number of current seated members of Congress continues to dwindle as another member of Congress has decided to pull the plug on seeking re-election. That is North Carolina Representative Sue Myrick, who is the Republican out of North Carolina 9th District. Interesting play. She's got a big play on several committees, including Commerce and House Energy. Are you surprised that we're starting to see these numbers drop as quickly as we are? Alan, is this a surprise to you, or just people just getting tired of serving in Congress?
You know, I wouldn't draw too many conclusions from her. She's 70 years old. She's been around quite a long time, and as happens with a lot of people, they start thinking about whether it's worth it anymore, whether they want to have another chapter professionally in their lives, or whether they just simply want to take some time off. Some of the younger people who leave will sometimes say, this is my best chance to go make some more money. So I wasn't expecting it. I don't pay that close attention to the House. I wouldn't read too much into it, though, given her age and longevity.
Bob, what do you think?
I agree with Alan. She's been here for the better part of two decades. She's not a young woman. I'm sure she's got some family back home and probably some grandkids, and I think she'd probably like to relax a little bit. And it's going to be a campaign in North Carolina. It's going to be a pretty aggressive campaign this year. It's going to be a battleground state. It'll be a lot of activity, and she may have a strong opponent for all I know. But I suspect she's doing it because she wants to lead.
North Carolina 9 has always been a traditional Republican stronghold.
Yep.
Do you think the Democrats have already written that off, or is that something that they might eye and say, there could be a blue dog Democrat, we might be able to slip in there with today's political environment?
You know, they're not going to just say, oh, never mind. They're going to suddenly, whereas they, it's not one they would have contested seriously before, they'll pay attention to who emerges, but it is a pretty strong, highly likely to be, continue to be Republican district.
Bob?
I agree.
The other big news coming out of Capitol Hill today was the announcement regarding Senator Nelson and the somewhat open Senate seat coming out of Nebraska. Bob, I think you're familiar with what's going on over there. What's happening on that decision?
Well, Senator Nelson, who was a former, he's a Democrat. He's been a senator for two terms. He was, before that, he was governor, and he's probably the most popular state figure, has decided to retire. And
he's out of politics completely.
Yes, he's just decided he wants to retire. The Democrats made a very strong effort to recruit a previous governor and who's also a previous senator, Bob Kerrey, who was also very popular and would have been a very formidable candidate for any Republican running statewide in Nebraska, even though it is a Republican state, I think. But both the senator is retiring, Senator Nelson, and former Senator Kerry is saying that he does not wish to run.
Is that a big win for the Republicans, Alan?
Well, I don't know about it. I think it's
when you're talking about two senators with name recognition coming from a state that's pretty much up for grabs.
Well, I wasn't that surprised that Nelson stepped down. He was going to be in for a tough fight, and he's been kind of a loner in his own party, and that's never fun. He's also getting up there in age, and so I wasn't as surprised that he stepped aside. I was not at all surprised that Bob Kerrey said enough. He left the Senate to go to move to New York City and to be president of the New School University, which he did for any number of years. He's got all kinds of irons in the fire. It's very rare that a senator who leaves voluntarily ever chooses to go back. He hasn't been spending that much time in Nebraska. He would have had to work hard to get this, but he knows what it's like to be in the Senate. He doesn't particularly choose to pursue that endeavor, so that was no surprise at all. I don't know the state well enough to know who the candidates will be, but this the fact that Nelson's out and Kerry is not in, again, not a surprise, but that it would have been a surprise if Kerry had jumped in, is good news for Republicans. It'll certainly increase their chances.
Is this a sign of things to come, Bob? I mean, are we going to start seeing more decisions the closer we get to November, and the more we see some of these redistricting maps in particular be finalized in each state?
I think we've seen most of the announcements. Most of the redistricting has been completed. A few states are still haggling either in the courts or in the legislature. But most of the people who are thinking about retiring have made their mind up. You know, most of the primaries come in the next 90 days, and most people have made their mind up by then, because obviously, if you're an incumbent, you want to, whatever party you're in, you most likely, if you're voluntarily leaving, you want to help your possible successor and give them a good chance to get started early. And so I think most of the people who are going to retire have made that announcement.
But when we look at Nebraska in particular, you know, right now, former Senator Kerry's decision, he's got a good job in New York City. He's been living there for the past 10 or so years, heading up a college in Manhattan.
And he's also, Senator Nelson is retiring, is not young, and Senator Kerry is older than he is. And I agree with Alan. I mean, he's doing what he left voluntarily once. Why would he go back?
But, Alan, does this leave the Dems kind of, you know, holding an empty bag right now? I mean, the people we're talking about that are possible contenders aren't even name recognized outside of certain districts. I mean, you're talking about one of them is a state senator out of Omaha named Lathrop. He's on the Board of Regents, and The other one is Chuck Hasselbrook, who's also on the Board of Regents at the University of Nebraska. Are the Democrats just lost right now in Nebraska?
I don't even remember who the Republican candidate is. You beat somebody with somebody, and that works both ways. The Republicans have to have somebody credible, so do the Democrats. There's plenty of time for a person to aim out a strong campaign. There's plenty of time for a leading candidate to screw up, make mistakes, and open the door for the other. Having said that, this is a seat that almost regardless of the nominee is likely to end up in Republican hands.
The other big news coming out of Washington. Go ahead.
One more wild thought on Nebraska. There's a gentleman in Nebraska who has plenty of money and he's getting ready to retire. His name is Warren Buffett. Wouldn't he be a candidate?
I would venture to say he
could certainly finance his own campaign.
I would venture to say that the Oracle of Omaha probably running for Senate not on his bucket list right now.
I would think he's too smart for that.
No, because actually the White House is probably hoping he'll take the Treasury slot after the second election. But that's another story. We're starting to see a lot of key names drop out of the Hill, and we're going to be losing, we've talked about this before, we're going to be losing a lot of solid, long-serving, experienced talent on the Hill. Is this a good thing for the Hill? Is this basically, you know, a cleansing of the palate, or are we losing enough talent to whereas we could see politics worse than usual in the upcoming months? Bob?
Well, politics as usual is pretty bad right now. I don't see how it could get much worse as far as trying to get solutions to problems that everybody knows has to be solved and nobody wants to do it. I don't expect that the election in November will see the kind of sea change we saw in the last election, particularly in the House of Representatives. It's possible that the Republicans, who only need two or three seats, it'd be three seats to get a majority in the Senate, could very well do that because North Dakota and Nebraska are two pretty good states for Republicans to pick up Democratic seats. And I think most prognosticators would say they could probably pick up those seats. So it's possible Virginia could be a takeover, too. So you can see that there are chances for the Republicans to gain a relatively narrow but nonetheless working a narrow majority in the Senate, which would give them control of both the House and the Senate, which would be an interesting situation if Mr. Obama is president.
Right. Is this, if, in fact, the Senate is won by the Republicans and the Republicans manage to maintain control of the House,
which is not a given at all. Nothing's a lot.
Especially in this environment, if that were to happen, is the potential political logjam getting worse and worse with the idea that we could have a Republican full Congress and a Democratic White House?
You know, we got a logjam regardless. And the most people don't understand how the Senate works, but it is fair to say that on any important matter, you need 60 votes. So you may have a working majority in terms of a 51, 52, 53 majority, one party or the other. You get to select committee chairs. You get to set the agenda. You get to decide what comes up when. But that doesn't mean you get to pass whatever it is you're trying to pass. You still have to have bipartisan compromise at some level on anything big. We can never lose sight of that. It's important who controls the Senate, but it is not dispositive. It doesn't solve everything.
No. And, Bob? And I would suggest that the Senate itself is going to be just, if we have a situation which the Senate is closely divided and the Republicans are in the majority, we have to remind ourselves that I'm sure there are a number of Democrats, particularly on the more liberal side, who are sick and tired of so many of the Republicans, stopping them from getting things done, in effect forcing them to find 60 votes. So if the Republicans are in a position of having well under 60 votes, having the same kind of majority that the Democrats now have, I can see a lot of Democrats, do a little payback.
Does this scenario in the Senate give independents, i.e., the good senator out of Connecticut, does this give them a little bit more stroke to maybe pick and choose their battles on either side of the aisle?
Well, the answer is, I suppose, yes, but you still have to have 60 votes. The difference between 50, let's say going from you have 52 or 3 Republicans, you get to 56 or 7 by getting a couple of conservative or independents, you still haven't got 60. I mean, Alan is exactly right. In the Senate, you have to have 60 votes to get anything serious done that is very partisan or very difficult.
But Alan, does Lieberman, in fact, have a little bit more stroke in that type of a minority?
Well, remember,
majority?
Remember, Lieberman is one of those who's leaving at the end of the year. So
yeah, that's true,
it doesn't matter.
That's true.
I think what you do see, though, almost regardless of who ends up with the majority in the Senate and who ends up with the White House, the president has got to be very involved in working with the Congress. And I think one of this president's biggest shortcomings, and I think about it as a shortcoming more than a mistake, because he really was not steeped in how Washington worked. He had served less than a full term in the Senate. The first 2 years he kind of worked, and the next 2 years he wandered the country and ran for president. Even the first 2 years he was out on the road an enormous amount because he was a refreshing new figure. He talked a great game about working together, but he had never worked together. Not in the U.S. Senate, and he's learned a lot, and he's learned that he can't just say to the Congress, "You guys work it out and bring it to me." He has got to sit down across the table with his political opponents and try to work stuff out and be a much more present force in those kinds of conversations. And if Romney's the candidate and Romney's the president, he's going to have the same problem in the Senate. And who knows about the House, but you know, nobody's going to have a great big majority in the Senate. You're going to have to work across the aisle, no matter which party comes to power.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word on this subject. When we come back, we want to talk about the other breaking news. Two very key court decisions, one out of the Supreme Court regarding Obamacare, the other one coming out of the District Court of Appeals regarding California's Proposition 8, a big turn there. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Thank you. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We're now going to switch from Capitol Hill to a couple of other items that are either in the courts or facing the courts. The big news today, the breaking news, is the decision on Proposition 8 out of California. It appears right now that in a 2-1 majority of a 3-member panel at the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit out in California, basically ruled Proposition 8, which was the 2008, I believe, mandate outlawing gay marriage in California, brought forward by then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. In the ruling, Judge Stephen Reinhart wrote for the majority, stating, quote, Proposition 8 serves no purpose and has no effect other than to lessen the status and human dignity of gays and lesbians in California and to officially reclassify their relationships and families as inferior to those of opposite-sex couples. That is a huge, huge ruling, and it affirms the lower court's ruling regarding the same issue. Alan, this is a big issue as far as gay rights and human rights here in the United States. This is a huge win for the gay community. How big and how much of an impact is this ruling going to have? And is this thing going to go to the Supreme Court, do you think?
Absolutely, 100%. It will go to the Supreme Court. The only question is whether the people who disagree with the ruling will ask for the full court the Ninth Circuit to sit on the issue because it was 2-1. My hunch is they won't. Everybody knows this is headed to the Supreme Court. The sooner the better. It's important to remember the context. The California Supreme Court, not the federal Ninth Circuit, but the California Supreme Court a few years ago ruled that gay marriages were legal, were constitutional. That's what fed the movement for Proposition 8. So what the circuit panel said was, wait a minute. A constitutional right in the state constitution cannot be simply taken away by a majority vote. This is a constitutional right. This wasn't one vote superseding another. That the original California Supreme Court decision was controversial, but it was a decision under California's constitution. And what these guys have said is, you can't simply by plebiscite, by a referendum, overrule and eliminate a constitutional right in the Constitution. And that's a violation of the federal Constitution, 14th Amendment.
But this is an odd decision because the basis of the lawsuit itself going to the appellate court was the fact that the lower court, there was a U.S. district judge named Vaughn Walker. They had asked that the ruling by Judge Walker be struck down because he has since, after he's come off the bench, disclosed he, at the time of the ruling, was in a long-term same-sex relationship. Bob, does that kind of seem like a reach a little bit? I mean, you're an attorney.
Come on, Mr. Constitutional Lawyer, tell us your law. You took con law in law school.
Let me step back from the legal wrangling and just say this. This is a perfect example of the problems with dealing with making all these social issues political issues, these social situations. You know, we're talking gay rights or abortions or all these kinds of things that are part and parcel of people's personal lives that don't, in one sense, you know, affect everybody. They affect their personal lives,
right,
how they want to lead them. Now, obviously, if you decide that means you could have a Thompson machine gun and shoot out your window, that's one thing. But questions about, gay marriages, gay rights, abortion issues, those kinds of things are the most personal kind of things you can have. And trying to solve them are awfully hard to do by fiat, either by the court or legislation. And it just shows you constantly how we're never going to solve these problems to this to the place where it goes away.
But basically, the plaintiffs in this case are saying that Judge Walker was governing from the bench. He was legislating from the bench. Is that fair?
Well,
it is. It is. If you believe that because he was in that kind of relationship, it clouded his judgment.
Alan?
Well, this court ignored that whole issue. It said, okay, let's look at the facts in the case, and we'll make a judgment on what we think the proposition's relationship to state law was, and they concluded that it was under the federal constitution an unconstitutional action that was in violation of the federal constitution. It doesn't, in this case, what they did is they just, I don't know if they addressed that other question, but they basically, it appears that they ignored it. It was not going to be, hey, this guy was somehow tainted, throw it back to him. It was, let's move forward and get this going. Everybody knows it's going to the Supreme Court anyway. And that's where it'll be.
Now, this is a huge blow to the Defense of Marriage Act and the position that, the neutral position, I guess you could say, that the Obama administration has been taking on DOMA. Is this an open door for Obama to come out and support his liberal backers and saying, hey, we got a shot now to actually do away with anything dealing with DOMA, dealing with Prop 8? Will we see a more active role in the Obama administration to say equal rights to all?
Well, look, there are other issues we could talk about later, possibly, that touch on people's personal beliefs and whatnot that the Obama administration has waded into, and I think politically unwisely. This could be another one. I mean, you can make an awful lot of people unhappy. They don't have to wade into it. They can say it's in the courts, and they can avoid it. And I would think from a political standpoint, that would be a better decision than to weigh in on one side or the other of this case.
Alan?
I think they will weigh in. I think that their position is pretty clear here. It's interesting, the president himself, from a personal standpoint, has tried to walk this narrow line to say he believes that gays and gay unions, gay couples, should be treated the same way as heterosexual couples, but he has held off embracing full marriage rights. That has been a frustration to some of his followers. This case does not by itself grant full marriage rights. What it does is it tosses Prop 8, which brings back into play
legalization
of gay marriages. And I think that, so I'm guessing what they will do is say, we agree with attorneys Ted Olson and David Boies, who argued this case, who
right.
come from political extremes, the lead lawyers in on both sides in Bush v. Gore, 12 years ago.
And Ted Olson being the former Solicitor General of the United States.
And on the same side here.
And on the same side here. And he'll say, I agree with those guys. But, you know, all these guys, he doesn't have to speak out, but he's going to be looked to say something. And the administration has taken, in some ways, a more controversial position on the Defense of Marriage Act, where they unilaterally decided that even though it is the law of the land, the Justice Department is no longer going to argue in court to uphold it, to protect it. So he would like to toss the Defense of Marriage Act, and you can toss Defense of Marriage. Remember what Defense of Marriage Act does? It doesn't assure equal marriage rights. What it does do is what it would do if you wouldn't do it is say, gay couples in same-sex marriages, in
long-term
gay,
relationships,
in gay marriage legal or same-sex union states would not automatically be prohibited from gaining any of the rights that under federal programs
right.
and federal law that have heretofore been the exclusive province of heterosexual marriages.
But when you look at the makeup of the three-judge panel, you've got the senior appellate judge in this one, Reinhart. He was appointed by Jimmy Carter. He was affirmed by Justice Michael Day, Michael Hopkins, rather, who was appointed by Bill Clinton. And the dissension, in the one dissenting vote in the panel, was by Judge Randy Smith, who was appointed by Bush. Is this now a overtly political decision that's going to move forward, or can the Supreme Court really look at the entire picture in this based on the plaintiff's case of throwing out the ruling on Proposition 8 because the judge in the lower court had a same-sex relationship? How's this going to play out?
I don't think the lower court's judges' sexual preference is any longer an issue. I think the issue that will go
this decision made that clear.
Issue that will go to the Supreme Court is unless the 2-1 decision by the panel goes to the full Ninth Circuit, in which case. That we're still in a waiting game, but assuming this is what goes forward, it's the content of this decision that will be in the purview of the Supreme Court, and they will decide whether they agree with this 2-1 panel or disagree.
And Bob? And my guess is that there's very little reason for anybody to want to seek the full Ninth Circuit to review this. The Ninth Circuit is by all measures, I think, reasonable, fair measures, is probably the most liberal circuit court in the country. So they're certainly going to affirm the decision, I would believe. And it would just mean that the case takes longer to get to the Supreme Court. Because it's going to be argued based upon the decision that was made this week.
Now, the other big decision that came out of Washington this week is the decision by HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, which I incorrectly, not the Supreme Court ruling, there's been several rulings this week several news items regarding religious organizations. There was a former Supreme Court ruling regarding religious organizations that I got confused with the decision by the Obama administration and Secretary Sebelius and the fight over Catholic religious organizations, calling it the birth control mandate. Basically, there are two federal lawsuits that have been filed, one in D.C. by Catholic University, the other in Colorado, contending that this ruling is going to go to legal battles. But bottom line here is, Alan Lingo, to you, what is the bottom line on this decision regarding religious organizations and the Obama birth control ruling?
The bottom line is, the Obama administration made an avoidable, stupid blunder by getting out front on this issue at this point in time. The issue is an interesting one. They did not have to make a final judgment now. They knew this was going to be controversial. They've shown a great willingness to kick cans down the road on other issues, but in this case, for some reason, I think they thought, well, it's going to help us more than hurt us, and they have a firestorm on their hands, not just from Catholics, including Catholics who are fully supportive of contraception.
Right, yeah.
No, you can be fully supportive of contraceptive rights. You can even be a pro-choice Catholic who can be offended by the federal government saying, every single solitary Catholic organization other than churches themselves must finance, pay for, subsidize
for
contraception, including vasectomies, tube ties, sterilization of the morning after pill, which is got its own special questions, as well as the other more conventional forms of birth control, the pill, the IUD, condoms, etc. And for churches, who, I mean, there are people, and Rick Santorum is a great example. He doesn't even believe in contraception. He doesn't
right.
use it. He doesn't believe in it, but he's not trying to take the right away.
Right.
But what this ruling would require is that Catholic organizations, who as a matter of faith, whether they live it in their personal lives or not, are opposed to contraception, would be forced to subsidize contraceptive sterilization and morning after type pills to all of their employees. And this will be a major court decision. Is this requirement a violation of the First Amendment? It may be. They have got this firestorm on their hands, the Catholic hierarchy all over the United States. Catholic churches all over the U.S. are reading letters to congregations. This announcement was made January 20th. It's been out there, and it's sort of been brewing and coming to a head. And what's interesting now is that realizing they've got a tiger's tail by the hands here, you saw David Axelrod, who doesn't even work in the White House anymore. He's an important player, but he's on the campaign saying, well, there may be room for compromise. And you're thinking, wait a minute, how is it that a campaign advisor is talking policy for the White House? It's suggestive of the disarray. I do believe that the president's press secretary today said, we're going to be talking to these groups. We're hoping that we can find some common ground here. They are backing away from this because they do not want a unified Catholic Church hierarchy and a bunch of court cases to be fomenting anger and distress throughout the next 8 months.
This ties directly into Obamacare. I mean, let's be real. Let's look at the bigger picture in this. Under Obamacare, you have to subsidize these ideas of birth control, even though it may go directly against the core functionality of a religious organization, whether it's a Catholic church-backed hospital, or whether it's a religious organization based on family planning. Under Obamacare, you don't have the right to opt out. This is a mandate. Is this also, along with questioning the issue on Obamacare, is this also going to muddy the waters regarding separation of church and state?
Well, it's a First Amendment question about as blunt and visible as I've ever seen an administration take a shot at. I mean, religious freedom means you have a right to believe, and your church has a right to believe certain policies. And there is no and obviously, if the government can say whether you believe or not, we're going to force you to do something that violates your principles, is what they're doing here, it seems to me. Now, I am sure there are other churches, other faiths that will look at this and probably say to themselves, you know, maybe we're going to be next. It's not a smart decision. I agree with Alan. This could have been pushed down the road a little bit. Example, the pipeline. That's a very controversial issue among a lot of Democrat group supporters, like unions who'd like to have it done.
Right.
But the president has pushed it down the road because he doesn't want to decide it at this point during the campaign. It would have been a lot more sensible for him to push this down the road and find a way to get some solution to this, or at least attempt to get a solution, because all he's going to do is get people who are going to get up there and say, why should I vote for a president who wants to make me violate my First Amendment rights? He's taking my rights away.
But this also affects, you know, you look at, state laws in California, New York. Those states have exemption to houses of worship, quote unquote. That there are certain waivers that you can get by being a house of worship, but not necessarily as a Catholic, quote unquote, charity, such as hospitals or other employers of that sort. Is this also an issue regarding states' rights of being able to govern the houses of worship and the religious organizations in their state?
You know, it's a good question. I don't know enough about how it works in the states. I know there are some states that apparently require all employers of a certain size to if they're going to provide health insurance, provide a certain package of services, including contraceptive services. I don't know how they work. I do know that in at least some states, the way they make that work is that you say to your employees, if you as an employer do not want to for have religious or moral reasons not to pay for contraception, then you have to make it possible for your employees to purchase insurance directly from an insurance company to cover those kinds of services. It's cumbersome. It's awkward. It's one way to get around it.
Yeah.
I'm sure that when they were wrestling with this decision, they were looking at some of these other at these other options, but they decided to go for broke. They decided that that because most Americans believe in contraceptives, most Americans use or have used contraceptives in their own personal lives, that they could jam this through. And it was a horrendous miscalculation and has created a terrible diversion and united the Catholics like you can't believe. And the Catholics were 27% of the electorate in the last election. 27%, and they broke 44, 46 for Obama the last time around. This is big time politics.
Secretary Sebelius obviously has a green light to push this thing like a rocket out of the gate.
She did have until today on the weekend.
Well, no, I mean, look, she even said yesterday in USA Today, she said, quote, by carving out an exemption for religious organizations based on policies already in place, we are working to strike the right balance between respecting religious beliefs and increasing women's access to critical preventive health services. I mean, she's basically saying that the health of the individual woman outweighs the rights of your personal religious beliefs of an organization. That, to be an op-ed in USA Today, has got to get the blessing somehow of the White House for that to go forward. I mean, they're not holding back on this, Bob.
No, they're not. And I think it's also interesting, we talked earlier before we got started here, it's interesting that so many of the organizations that are praising the president are, in effect, abortion, pro-abortion, pro-contraception organizations, which, in effect, it helps to energize people who say, my God, they're taking a shot at our religious beliefs.
This is in the same, literally, like, 96-hour news cycle as the news of the Susan G. Komen fiasco, as regarding Planned Parenthood. I mean, this was not a well-thought-out process coming out of the White House, out of a White House that is normally looked at as being very risk-averse and very cerebral when it comes out to especially these types of firestorm political actions.
It's ironic to me that whenever a political candidate on the stump screws up, makes a comment that can then be blown up and taken out of context. Mitt Romney's made several, Gingrich has made some, Santorum fewer, but people haven't been paying as close attention to him. Ron Paul makes them all the time.
And here you've got.
There is that.
And why should he?
Yeah.
But here you've got a massive operation with people who are technocrats, people who are political types, campaign folks. One where you'd think, this is not the kind of mistake you expect from a well-run organization. And this is a big one. And as Bob said, it doesn't help the administration right now, or for that matter, the Susan B. Komen Foundation, that the main voices on the liberal side, if you will, are pro-choice or pro-abortion rights organizations. And you don't want that. It's entirely possible to be completely anti-abortion and completely pro-contraceptive. Read Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. He writes about this all the time. Anybody who's dealt with it in global health and in health for the poor tends to become a huge proponent of contraception. But you can be pro-contraception and anti-choice. the voices are all the pro-choice folks here, and that's exactly what this administration does not want.
I mean, this has already had some political outfall, especially on the Susan G. Komen side. Karen Handel, who was the vice president for public policy, who was largely seen as the architect of the Planned Parenthood decision, she got dumped earlier today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So are we going to? I mean, is this a career dissipation warning for Secretary Sebelius, do you think?
Well, I don't know about that, but that's just another example of the heat of this issue. It will not go away.
No.
This is a hot issue. It's not going to go away, and I would suspect that the president is going to have to do a lot of backing and filling on this one, and he certainly is going to have – he's going to make, as Alan said, there's an awful lot of Catholics who voted for Obama who probably today think – he is telling me, you know, what my church can and can't do.
Telling us what our Catholic hospital has to do, our Catholic university, our Catholic social services organization, our international
any organization that employs people.
That's affiliated
that's
with the church.
With any church. Yeah. I mean, this affects,
probably,
I mean, if you think the Catholics are going to be outraged by this, wait till you get a hold of the Southern Baptist Convention and see the firestorm that's going to come out of that brimstone fire.
And consider this. So many religious congregations are deeply involved in health and human services to the poor in their communities. Hugely. The Catholic Church is huge in that area, and I know other churches are as well. And they're all got to be looking at something like this and saying, are we next? What are they going to jump us about? And that's the kind of stuff that is just going to get them crazy. I mean, this is religious freedom. I thought this was America.
Yeah, well, see, and that's my point. And I want to take off my moderator hat for a second and saying, look, for full disclosure, I am a recovering Catholic. I am pro-choice, largely pro-choice, which is unusual for Republicans in these days. The reality is, you know, I look at this. Even though I may be pro-choice, and I don't necessarily agree with the edict coming out of the Vatican in Rome, I still, you know, even as a recovering Catholic, still have to go and abide by, you know, look, even though I don't agree, it's still the religious mandate of my beliefs. And for Secretary Sebelius to come out here and say, well, your beliefs are wrong, is just, to me, outlandish. It doesn't make sense. And I venture to say, I'm not the only Catholic or recovering Catholic that feels this way.
I would say there's a number of them.
Well, the administration is clearly scrambling now. I mean, it was, as I said, it was bizarre to have David Axelrod from the campaign in Chicago saying, well, maybe we can work something out. But now it's the press secretary in the White House.
Jay Carney's coming out.
They are rethinking this, but they have stepped into it, and it's like Susan B. Komen. You can undo your decision, but you can't undo all the damage.
I was going to say, can the Obama administration do enough damage control to where it won't affect them in fundraising, perhaps, or even in the general election in November, Bob?
Well, I don't know what kind of mechanisms or what they're going to do between now and, let's say, 6 or 8 weeks from now, trying to find some way to wiggle out of this problem. But having done it, the damage is this what they're going to do as soon as they get a chance to do it when the election's over, if they're still in office? You know, those are the kind of questions that people are going to ask. This is something that they either have to say, we were wrong, we're never going to touch this again, and if they don't do that, which I doubt that they will, they'll try to find some way short of that.
Well, I would venture
that people are going to be – there are a lot of people who are not going to trust them on this issue at all.
I would venture to say that we will probably see, with the lawsuits being done in D.C. and Colorado, we still have not heard from the larger archdiocese, i.e. New York, Boston, Chicago.
Just wait.
This is obviously a fight that's going to go legal very quickly. The big question is, we are going to see this go to the Supreme Court, Alan?
Well, it'll certainly go to federal court. It starts below the Supreme Court, but actually the new cardinal-designate Archbishop Dolan in New York City has been very out there and active on this issue already, and they are talking about being heard and about a possible march on Washington over this issue. So the Catholic bishops are they communicate well. They're focused, and if they get passionate about something, watch out. They bring cardinals to Washington to lobby.
Right.
This would not be the first time, and it's pretty powerful stuff
when the entourage surrounding a cardinal walks into your congressional office.
Dresses in red and comes in to say, hey, and you've got a big Catholic constituency. It's just a really interesting.
This is going to be a big issue.
It's going to be a very big issue.
It's going to be a big issue. And by the way, for my canon law student friends from here in Shelley's, you'll probably be getting a phone call in the next week because we would love, one of my friends happens to be the Archbishop in Peoria for the Archdiocese. Would love to get his take on this one. We may have to get him in next week as a guest.
The Council of Bishops, the Conference of Bishops, I guess, the Conference of Bishops
Conference.
Is going to certainly speak on this subject. I am quite sure that already the senior cardinals have talked about it and how to proceed. I'm sure they are wondering whether they should go directly to the White House themselves immediately and start having a conversation. Or what, but there's no doubt at all that this is going to be something that gets bigger quickly.
Well, it's gotten very big, and it took over two weeks, but the White House is now blinking and pushing back. And so what they're going to they've started over the weekend and today, dropping back.
Creating a damage control plan.
Damage control, saying, well, we are open to compromise. There may be some ways we can work something out.
Let me interrupt real quick. CNN is reporting right now that the White House is quote unquote open to compromise on the bishop's concern.
They are obviously listening to us over the White House, and it's about time. We could have told them. If they would talk to us ahead, we would have said, don't do this.
Proof positive that they're listening to us in 1600 Pennsylvania. Yeah, that's
right.
All I'm saying.
You know, the other thing that's interesting with them is that about this particular issue is this one is about contraception. And we can get into the weeds. The morning after pill.
Don't go there. I'm just saying that's a whole other topic for a whole other discussion.
Well, the morning after pill, they know, can slow everything down. It slows sperm down. It slows the egg down. It reduces
the family show.
It reduces the likelihood of conception. What's not known, and you could never do any experiments on the subject, what is not known is whether it actually creates an abortion within the first couple of days. Some people believe it does. There's no good scientific evidence. I used to study this stuff a little bit. But if you think about this as contraception and these sterilization procedures, it's now caught up in the abortion issue, which is really unfortunate if you're a believer in birth control, sex education, and so on. But because the Komen issue with Planned Parenthood is tied up with abortion, because Planned Parenthood is the nation's biggest abortion provider. And for these to come to a head at the same time doubles the problem for the White House.
I want to ask you, last question on the subject before we go to break and we talk about some international stuff. And Alan, I'm going to direct this at you because this is a subject that you're very close to and it's close to your heart. Is this a pattern that we're seeing out of the Obama administration? You know, we saw President George W. Bush being very supportive of AIDS preventive measures in Africa.
Yep.
We saw him very active in AIDS prevention here and AIDS treatment here in the United States. We don't see that kind of activity coming out of the Obama administration regarding Africa, regarding domestic AIDS issues. Is this a pattern that we're seeing, that there's just not an in-touch sense of reality coming out of the White House and out of the Obama administration?
I wouldn't say that on this issue. This administration and Secretary Clinton, Secretary Sebelius, they're actually quite good on this issue. Their problem is no money. So whereas during the Bush years, you saw this incredibly rapid scale-up from about $500 million on global AIDS to in the neighborhood of $6 billion after 8 years, with just an extraordinary amount of growth and spending. The Obama in the campaign said he wanted to continue to have these programs grow. Secretary Clinton was very good on this stuff in the Senate, from my standpoint, but there just isn't money to do this stuff. So,
well, round the horn before we break. Are the Supremes going to hear this issue, do you think, Bob?
Unless the president backs off, they will undoubtedly get this
Alan?
Decision.
Well, it depends on this reassessment going on in the White House. So they're backing down. They're going to modify the policy. We have to know what the new policy is before we know whether there will be legal challenges.
Interesting point. Okay, we still have an entire show agenda to get through regarding outside of the breaking news that we're talking about. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Middle East. The Middle East is continuing to intensify. The situation in Syria degrades minute by minute. The Iranian situation is now coming to a head in some instances. We'll be back. Oh, by the way, it's happy hour, so we're going to do this while we're having our wine, our beer, and our Jack, and smoking our cigars. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio as we enter our second hour. We're going to change pace a little bit right now, and we're going to start talking about just the ever-growing tensions in the Middle East. It is a complete challenge to the Obama administration, and in particular, Secretary of State Clinton. Basically, there's two fronts right now that we're looking at, that being Syria, the continuing violence in Syria, and the Iranian nuclear issue. Let's start on Syria. President Assad has taken a tremendously violent stance against opposition to his government in Syria. It is continuing to be, one could classify it as a humanitarian crisis of some sort. Thousands of people have lost their lives. There were, the UN estimates that well over 5,400 deaths have been attuned to the 11-month uprising that has asked for Assad to step aside. The Arab League has called for Assad, President Assad, to step aside. But what is shocking to many people is the UN Security Council vote over the weekend, in which Russia and China vetoed a resolution condemning Syria's treatment of the protesters, and that it was a basically internal domestic issue. Assad is blaming the uprising on armed gangs of thugs and terrorists, and they're the ones starting the violence, that they are just trying to protect their domestic rights inside their borders. But Syria is now the catalyst for what is, or what could be, a major ending chapter in the Arab Spring. First of all, let's look at the situation. Assad has been holding on to political power for a while, even though everybody around him has called for him to step aside. How is it that Assad is able to keep power inside Syria with the pressure surrounding him in the Arab League and internationally, Bob?
Well, he has the army. That's how he's been able to keep control. And that's all he's got. He's got his only friend in the Middle East right now is Iran.
Right.
Turkey has turned against him. The Arab League has turned against him vigorously. The UN Security Council, his resolution was vetoed by two nations, China and Russia.
Both of them have very strong ties to the Assad government, by the way.
Yeah, well, yeah. But they're, in effect, just letting... You know, it's, in one sense, the fact that we have that much of the world, Western Europe nations, everybody is saying in effect Assad is a problem, and he's got to go. He's got no support now in his own nation. The reality is, as long as the army is with him, and as long as he has guns and bullets, he's going to keep shooting. It looks like, I suspect it can't go on too much longer. Apparently, and I say apparently, I don't know very much about this internally, but I have seen, and I guess other people have too, there have been a number of reports that some of the military, not in whole groups, not in regiments, but numbers of military members have defected, taken their weapons with them, taken their equipment with them, and they have joined the rebels in the cities, Homs and Homs, and I think I can't think of another one. There's not even a major problem. But in any event, it's only getting worse. More and more people are now coming to into Damascus. And
right.
In parts of Damascus, there is killings going on in the last few days, serious killings, several hundred. I mean, that probably can't last too much longer.
But a major development that happened over the weekend was the fact that the U.S. had recalled its ambassador and has shut down all operations at the embassy in Damascus, which is a huge international relations situation for the United States. Basically, we pulled out of Syria.
And so have the Brits.
As have the Brits, the Italians, the
French, everybody.
As well as Arab states, Kuwait, mm-hmm. Bahrain, UAE, Oman, Qatar, have also recalled their ambassadors. At what point does Assad, Alan, look at this and saying, look, I understand the Western countries, but I got my neighbors now pulling out of this. You know, something's got to give here. Well, how does he balance that?
Well,
I mean, we're obviously trying to get into the mind of a madman here.
Exactly. So some people have an easier time doing that than others, and I have trouble doing that. I damn if I know what makes these guys tick. But I, you know, these guys have centralized power and control for a very long time. They've controlled the military, and they've controlled the country with a relative iron fist. The populace goes along. And then in the Arab Spring, suddenly what seems impossible starts happening. And it particularly in Egypt, where people did not think it would happen because they thought that same central authority existed and you would never be able to get you would never be able to have a popular uprising that would not be shut down literally by the military. But the military, these are citizens too. These are people. These aren't mercenaries. These are guys that are being asked to kill their fellow citizens and still talk to their moms and their dads and their brothers and sisters. And suddenly you get people either who defect, as Bob suggests, there's some indication some of these guys are, or they just lay down their arms, or they shoot over their heads. They don't shoot to kill. There are plenty of people who have, you know, don't mind the killing, but plenty of others who have real hesitation and reservation
about
this.
But, I mean, you look at the situation in Homs. You brought up Homs earlier, Bob. You know, I mean, they're not just, you know, it's not street combat. I mean, they are literally using heavy artillery and shelling Homs and the opposition in Homs. You know, but yet we look at the Russians, and by the way, just so we know, the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, is in Damascus right now and says that we're basically, what was his quote? He called it hysterical statements about the UN veto, that we're overreacting to a domestic situation in Syria. Is there logic in this?
In a diplomatic world, yes. But there is, remind ourselves, the Alawite sect, which are part of the Shiite group of Muslims, as opposed to the Sunni group, the Sunni part, which is about, I guess, about three quarters of the Muslim world. The Alawites are in about 10 or 15% of the population, and they are the ones who run the government and control Damascus and have for 50 years. Most of that population is Sunni. And the only real friend in the Arab world right now that our friends in Damascus have, that Bashar has, is Iran. And we can talk about Iran later on and their problems. But the fact of the matter is, you've got a situation there where Bashar does not have very many friends in his neighborhood. And I don't see how he can continue. I mean, I can understand how a Shiite might feel perfectly comfortable killing a Sunni, because they certainly feel comfortable doing the same thing next door in Iraq in the last 10, 20 years. But the fact of the matter is, it's going to blow up, because there's a heck of a lot more Sunnis out there in the nation of Syria than there are Alawite Shiites.
But now, when we talk about this, you know, the American response to this, some, particularly several senators, including McCain, Graham, and Lieberman, saying that we haven't provided the right response to this. We should be providing, if not full military support for the opposition, at least Libyan-type military influence in that area. What's the holdback from America right now?
You know, every one of these countries is different. We Americans don't know much about lots of individual countries around the world. They have their own history. They have their own ethnic mix. They have their leadership. They have the history of the leadership. They have the control of the military. And some places lend themselves to NATO bombing runs, if you will, supported by the U.S., as it was the case in Libya. Some don't. And sometimes it's population densities and a whole host of things, and you know, the situation in Syria, I'm not an expert on it, but But the very fact that we have not led from behind, as some unfortunate advisor described it, in Syria, I think we've provided leadership in terms of trying to get this to the UN, where we thought that there was some pan-Arab support as well as European support, but the Chinese and the Russians decided, well, they've got a different feeling about it. Sometimes it's economic concerns. Sometimes it's a fear that, gee, if you're Russia and you're talking about intervening on the part of the UN, at least in terms of resolution, what about a resolution for some of the behavior that Russia has carried out down in Chechnya and in Georgia? There's a whole host of factors that these countries look at, but they don't want to be isolated either. Russia's trying to join the family of nations, and it's a natural gas and oil dependent economy, and it's pretty much a basket case beyond that. But it still wants to be a player, doesn't want to be isolated. So you send your foreign minister in there, and there's probably some behind the scenes serious conversations. The Russians would like nothing better than to come out of there and say, we have brokered a deal. We are big time players.
But you look at 5,400 dead, according to some estimates. You look at 19 dead just today in Homs. Does this not justify maybe boots on the ground or active military participation, Bob?
This is a lot different than Libya.
Why?
Well, Libya is a country that the battles in Libya, it was over a 300-mile strip of land that was 25 miles wide. It was from Benghazi's at the eastern end of the country
to Tripoli
on the western end,
right,
at 25 miles inland. That's it. And so you were dealing with a couple of roads, and you were dealing with military here and there. Here you've got, and they have 6 million people in the whole place in Libya. Here you've got a country with still 40,000 people, I guess.
Million
people. Yeah, million people. You've got major cities. Everybody is mixed up together. How do you deal with something like that? I mean, the military is, if they're shooting at you, they're from here to across the street, maybe. How do you settle with that? How do you deal with that? You can't deal with that the way we did with Libya. It's a different world.
And boots on the ground is not an option. I mean,
I don't think this is
something, you know, when the president says not so much with regard to Syria, but in general, he'll say, well, we don't take any options off the table. Believe me, that's an option that's not on the table.
When we stood back, I mean, this is almost identical blueprint. I mean, President Assad is taking a page out of his dad's playbook off of a similar uprising that happened 30 years ago, and his response was just as every bit as brutal as his son is doing today. Don't you think that DOD, State Department, the White House is looking at that saying, the last time we didn't take action, the Assad family still maintained control? Shouldn't we use that as a blueprint?
Well, a blueprint for what? You know, what kind of action might we have done 30 years
ago? What about UAV support? What? We didn't have UAVs 30 years ago, but what about UAV support now?
You know, what we increasingly discover is, A, we get into a slippery slope of providing more help, and then we're more and more sucked in and looked to for armaments, for economic aid, and so on. A. B, if we'd like Assad to step aside, we'd like a peaceful transition. There's no assurance that you get a peaceful transition either. I mean, look what's going on in Egypt today.
Yeah.
Look what's going on in Iraq today. So we got crappy choices all the way around.
We don't need another country with a crappy choice to make.
But there is nobody that says there'll always be a handful of members of Congress who want to be critical of the president but
Joe Lieberman, an independent who has been supportive of Obama.
But Lieberman, McCain, and Graham are sort of a triumvirate hawk group in the Middle East. So it's not a surprise they would talk about being more aggressive. When it gets murky when you get into the details. They do not have a big following.
All right, we're gonna blow through the break in this segment, because there's a lot going on. I'm going to keep Syria on it because it's going to directly tie into the other question, and that's Iran. The Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, last Friday said that a couple of interesting things. One, that Iran was looking to strike America on its own soil. And number two, he came out and said that Bibi Netanyahu's government in Tel Aviv had plans ready and were ready to pull the trigger on an assault on the Iranian nuclear capabilities inside Iran. The other interesting situation was during an interview with Matt Lauer prior to the Super Bowl, the president kind of backed off that message from Secretary of Defense Panetta, saying, well, we're not sure. We're still talking. We're still negotiating. Number one, you know, we've got two stories coming out of Washington. What's the right story? I mean, do we, in fact, want to support an Iranian strike on Israeli strike by the IDF on Iranian soil to wipe out that capability? And are we putting ourselves in greater danger the longer we wait?
Well, I mean, I don't know that Israel, if they wanted to attack Iran, could do irreparable harm to their nuclear program anyway, because I don't know that they have the kind of weapon you're going to need to be able to blow up these underground facilities they built where they're doing all their enrichment of the uranium. I don't think they've got the kind of weapons they could do it. And if Israel did that, immediately from Lebanon and from Syria and from maybe from, you know, Iran, they're going to start raining down missiles that, you know, go 500 miles or 300 miles. Israel's got a lot of people surrounding them who don't like them very well, and Israel is just going to get bombarded. I don't know that it's a good idea.
Yeah, but Alan,
I mean, it's just not a good plan right now.
I mean, that's never stopped Bibi Netanyahu before.
Well, I know, but he may be committing national hara-kiri.
But if in fact the Israelis wait, and in fact Washington and the State Department is able to hold Netanyahu back from pulling this trigger, if that is the case, the longer we wait, are the Iranians literally hunkering down further and further, making it more difficult for a strike to be effective, Alan?
Well, it appears that they are digging deeper and deeper into the earth to use soil as their big protectant for the stuff they're doing. That seems to be clear. At the same time, their economy is being damaged significantly by the sanctions that date back years and the more recent sanctions and controls on the Iranian central bank, which is making it very hard for them to sell their oil and their gas. They don't have much else to sell. I think they may still do pistachios. Except California messed that up for them years and years ago. They said, we're going to start growing pistachios.
And apparently pistachios are the only thing sustaining the Greek economy.
What is not clear is, you know, there's no approach you can take where you can feel really confident about success. And this is a big problem for the U.S. That's why Obama said the other night, you know, we're not taking any options off the table, but we'd still like a diplomatic solution. Netanyahu just in the last 24 hours said, I want all of my cabinet ministers and senior government officials to stop talking about this.
Right.
We don't want to hear people talking, speculating about what we're going to do. We'll do what we need to do when we do it. But the problem for everybody is you can bomb the hell out of Iranian soil where you think these things are a few hundred feet down. Maybe you can harm them, maybe you can't. Most of the stuff I've seen suggests you probably can't do more than set them back for a year or two. In the meantime, you are going to unleash God knows what in terms of a response from Iran towards Israel, towards the U.S., all this talk about striking America on the ground. I mean, we don't, when you're dealing with crazy people, and that's what we're dealing with as far as we, you know, in terms of the way we think. You got to be really, really careful if you can exterminate them, it's one thing. Not that that's always so wonderful, but we don't have any certainty of that. That we can either completely destroy their capability, either physical or human potential, and then you got a bunch of guys that have martyrdom on their mind and will take on anything.
But I mean, you know, with the latest disclosures from the Iranian government coming out of Tehran saying that they do want to take the war to the American soil, to me, and I don't come from the intelligence community background, I don't have to be in the intelligence community to think that, to me, strikes as language that poses a clear and present danger to the U.S. Could the U.S. justify supporting an Israeli attack?
I think if Israel, over our objections, decided to do it no matter what, I think what we would probably do is as soon as the Israelis have started doing it, I think we go to everyone, talk to every one of our Arab friends and say, look, you know, let's not get too carried away with this. Let's try to keep this as local as we possibly can, so the whole world doesn't blow up. And I don't know that it's possible to do that, but it's a very serious problem.
I mean, right now the Iranians have done everything from threaten U.S. warships that are transversing through what is, in the Iranian eyes, arguably international waters. This latest statement coming out of Tehran. At what point do we not see that as a
remind yourself that 2 weeks ago the admiral said, "We don't tell you this twice. Don't come through Hormuz." Last week, we sent an aircraft carrier through Hormuz and nothing happened. You know, they talk a lot. They know what will happen if they so much as spit on one of our ships. We have everything we need. We can destroy within an hour. We can totally destroy their navy, and we can destroy their bases and everything else around Hormuz. We can do everything we want to do within an hour. And they know it.
Very interesting.
But the reality is, that those kinds of things are things we hope we don't have to get involved in. But I think Alan said something very important. These people are crazy. Look, the idea that they would get involved in some nutty deal with a Mexican hitman to kill the ambassador of Saudi Arabia in a restaurant in Washington tells you how crazy, you know, the Secret Service of Iran, which is next to the top Khomeini and the rest of the mullahs, if that's the kind of thinking they go through to get back in an Arab country, look how crazy they are. So you don't know what they're going to do. I mean, they could do almost anything.
I mean,
all these leaders. I mean, in Iran, you got two leaders and some centers of power behind them. You got President Ahmadinejad, and you got the Ayatollah. They're both competing with each other and competing for public favor and competing for favor with people like Russia and China and who knows in Iraq and who knows where else. In Syria, you've got some people who are crazy in their own way. And whenever you're dealing with these people, we often hear these comments about, watch out for a cornered animal. You don't know what it will do.
Right.
And many times a cornered animal will basically sacrifice itself if it has to.
Right.
Rather than submit. And when you're dealing with that kind of an environment, you have to say, unless we know we can, pardon the expression, kill it dead on the spot, you may not want to wound it.
Interesting thought. I mean, this is going to be a developing story that we're going to be monitoring here on the show for a while. This is not going away anytime soon. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I don't know if anybody knew this, but there are 3 caucuses going on today out west. When we come back, we're going to talk about American politics. We're going to talk about the GOP race. And we're also going to touch on the Super Bowl ad that Clint Eastwood did and the firestorm that created. This is Backroom Politics Live. From Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
calmly waited, living on love and pale moonlight.
At Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from every Tuesday, 4 to 6 Eastern Time. So, a couple of things happening. One, a couple of friends of mine from Habitat for Humanity down in the First Coast, down in Northeast Florida here. We're going to talk to them here in a little bit. But, you know, shockingly, with all the news coming out of Washington and all the international news, I don't know if everybody knew. Hey, there's a couple of caucuses going on. Actually, there's three of them going on out west. Right now, the Republican parties in Colorado, Minnesota, and Missouri are meeting as we speak to try and come up with their delegation to represent their states at the Republican National Convention in Tampa. And the interesting thing was Romney seems to be on a roll. Mitt Romney had a huge win in Nevada, which kind of trumped Newt Gingrich's casino money, surprisingly to a lot of many inside the Beltway. Going off of the run in Florida that Mitt had, the success that he had in Nevada, is it becoming more and more prevalent that possibly Mitt is going to be the undisputed candidate going into Tampa, or is Newt still the giant killer? Bob?
I don't see, let me put it this way. Super Tuesday comes up 6th of March. There are about four or five southern states, Alabama, Mississippi,
Louisiana.
I'm thinking of there's another one, but I'm not. Tennessee.
Right.
And that's his last possibility. And I don't think that right now, I don't think he has the resources. He doesn't have troops on the ground. He doesn't have people, making calls and doing the kind of things you have to have done in each of those states. And those states are not small states. I mean, Tennessee is 500 miles wide. I mean, and he just doesn't have the staff to do it. Now, and I don't know, even somebody gave him $10 million suddenly, he could suddenly find the people to manage all the work that has to be done to develop the volunteers and get the work done. He thinks that's where he's going to stop Romney. I suspect. Now, remind yourself, too, these are proportional states. Once you get into, I think I'm right on that, the proportional states on Super Tuesday. So it's a question of he'll get some votes, he'll get some delegates, but he's not going to be able to stomp on Romney.
Alan, when we look at going into Colorado, when we look at what's going on in Colorado, what's going on in Minnesota and Missouri, the odd number that's coming out of this is the fact that not only is Newt Gingrich losing support down there or out there, but Santorum seems to be kind of picking up steam out in these western states. First question I have is, how important is Colorado to Romney? I mean, next door to Utah, his former state.
Well, Colorado is very important to Romney, and he will likely do quite well there. He did well there 4 years ago. He's got a good organization there. That makes a difference in Colorado. There's a reasonable number of Mormons out there. He needs to do well. He's likely to do well in Colorado. The real question is what happens in Minnesota and in Missouri. That's where Santorum has a shot at having a very good day. We'll see. That's the one big question mark on the day. I mean, you assume Romney will win, hopefully from his standpoint, big, but probably almost certainly win in Colorado. But will Santorum possibly win Minnesota, where the Republicans are very conservative? The caucus goers are very much like Iowa. So,
right.
So, you know, people draw that parallel. So he did, you know, Santorum eked out his arguable victory in Iowa, and maybe he could eke something out in Minnesota, which would be huge. Then in Missouri, the last of the three, by the way, no delegates are in play today. None. Zero. No delegates. But it's still what's happening today. It's three different states, and it'll be a lot of media and a lot of momentum. In Missouri, Gingrich is not on the ballot. So you've got a Romney-Santorum face-off in this beauty contest, and it's another terrific opportunity for Santorum. If he can pick up the Gingrich followers and his own supporters, there's an outside long-shot chance that Santorum could prevail in two out of three. That would be huge for Santorum if he can do that. It would mean he would have won more than Gingrich has. Gingrich has been trying to say, I'm the conservative alternative to the Massachusetts moderate Romney, which he dismissively describes. And if Santorum could pull this out, he's going to get, you know, he may get a win and a close second. Who knows? It'll give him momentum. It'll keep him going. Gingrich is the guy that's not going to have a good day.
He's going to have a bad Tuesday.
How good is Santorum's day going to
be? Bob.
Santorum has an advantage in one sense in Missouri because Gingrich isn't there. So all the very conservative votes likely will go with Santorum. But the other side of the coin is that Senator Roy Blunt, who's very popular in Missouri, and he ran several years ago, had a huge number. He's the chairman of Romney in Missouri, and that has got to be significant.
How big is the former governor's poll, and by former governor Huckabee? How big is the Huckabee factor out there
in Arkansas?
Yeah.
In Missouri.
I mean, even though he was governor of Arkansas, Huckabee had a strong showing in Missouri.
He had a strong showing in the southwestern part of Missouri.
Right.
He won a whole bunch of counties. He had a really great showing in this one part of Missouri.
Yeah.
And that's an area that Santorum has been working hard. He'd like to pull off what Huckabee did, because if you can do really well in one part of the state, that can help you in the Kansas Cities and the St. Louis's.
Does the fact that Rick Santorum always comes across as very Pawlenty-esque help him in these states, Bob?
What is Pawlenty-esque?
Well, he's very similar demeanor, very similar style.
I think he's much more out there than Pawlenty ever was. I mean, I would say. I mean, you know, he's got a pretty strong point of view, and he speaks his mind.
But these are people who arguably would have been Pawlenty factors had he stayed in.
Well, maybe in St. Louis or Kansas City, but not in the southwestern part
of
the state.
Well, who knows about Minnesota itself? But Pawlenty, remember. Is in the Romney camp,
right?
He has been one of the people who in recent days has been out of saying critical things of Santorum from a conservative standpoint. That don't get excited about this guy being your pure conservative. This is a guy who has been bragging about his success in getting earmarks for Pennsylvania for years and years and years. Now, to Santorum fights back, he doesn't have a whole lot of choice. He can't say, oh, well, I didn't really mean to do it. He says, wait a minute, I was elected by the people of Pennsylvania to fight for them, and that's
right.
What I've done. And I'm proud of the fact that I was able to bring home the bacon. The mood has changed, the mindset has changed. But Pawlenty, who still has, was a popular governor in Minnesota, he wasn't able to translate that into support for Iowa, where he bailed early. Who knows if he might have been able to. He's in the Romney camp and has been one of the main critics, the new critics. It's interesting that Romney in recent days and the super PACs that support him have begun to turn on Santorum,
right.
Especially for this in Minnesota and Missouri, because they're worried that Santorum might suddenly emerge and get a little momentum. And they would like to tamp all of this down and free up the path going forward.
Does Newt bank on there being any performance in any of these caucuses today, Bob?
He certainly hasn't spent any time in the states to get anything done.
Well, as of today, he's actually in Ohio.
Yes.
Which is a surprising move. But
as a good Buckeye, I welcome him to Ohio.
Hopefully they'll convince him to get out of the race.
Well, put him down. Hopefully we'll show him a coal mine and then seal it up.
Civility, Robert. Civility.
Better to be out of town when you're getting bumped.
Yeah.
Better
exactly.
Be than to be in town and in the state and still get bumped.
Yeah.
So
that's
you can say,
right.
Well,
point
I.
Point taken.
So
point taken.
He is not going to be a major factor today, and in an odd way, Gingrich probably has to hope that Romney has a good day, rather than Santorum, because Santorum and Gingrich are fighting each other for the non-Romney spot.
Who wins big tonight? Romney in all three? Does Santorum pick Minnesota?
I think Romney probably gets more total support today. And votes, or there's no votes technically, but he'll have a percentage. I bet his percentage will be bigger than anybody else's. Significantly.
I don't know. That's why we have these elections. Nothing will surprise me. If Santorum has a really good day in Minnesota and Missouri, that will surprise me, but not overwhelm me.
Really?
I think it's going to be a good day for Romney, given the momentum he's got, but we'll see.
One of the stories coming out of Nevada, though, that was surprising is the lack of turnout in Nevada. Is maybe Nevada a telltale sign that maybe we shouldn't be doing this right now?
Well, it may be one of two things. It may be that people say, oh, well, it's over, or I'm getting sick and tired of it.
Or none of these guys excite me enough to go out and vote for them.
No. Right. Okay.
I don't think it's a matter of timing. I don't think you can say we shouldn't be doing this now. I think it's, well, there's all this noise, pox on all of them. Let's stay home and
let's stay home and watch a good movie on television.
Right.
Interesting question. Okay, everybody, many people have DVRs now, right? So
right.
you can record your favorite program and watch it anytime you want, or you get Netflix and stream video into your house. There's good options.
That's
at
right.
home, and even if there's no sports, you can say, let's watch that movie we've been wanting to, or let's catch that episode of American Idol that's recorded on the machine, because why do we care about this other
right.
stuff?
Yeah. The other thing I want to talk about, obviously, this is going to be a telltale sign for the support Romney's getting out west, his first showing out west. But the other story I want to talk about before we go to break is the political issue that came out of the Super Bowl, which is the Clint Eastwood Chrysler ad. Aired at the end of halftime, which largely got huge support, and was a great message, but yet a lot of people are saying, hey, it was Clint Eastwood getting suckered in by the Obama administration to support Democrats, big union, big labor, and the bailout of the car industry. Is that fair, Bob?
Well,
first of all, did you see the ad?
Yeah.
Alan, did you see the ad?
I saw it.
Okay.
Yep.
What did you think of the ad, first of all?
I thought it was basically a Chrysler is back. American auto industry is back. And I thought that's what he thought. Let's put it that way. I can't imagine Eastwood, you know, wanting to cheer on the president particularly.
But Alan, was there anything in that struck you as being overtly political, or was it just a rah-rah message saying, hey, look, it's halftime, we're coming back. You can't keep this country down. We'll be stronger than ever again.
It was a rah-rah message.
It was 2 minutes.
He starts out talking, and you think, is that Eastwood? Who is that? Where are we? It turns out they were in New Orleans filming some of it. But
right.
Anyway, it was a story about Detroit, just an interesting little
right.
aside. And it's like, where are we going here? Where are we going here? Because we're all focused. Oh, my gosh, another Super Bowl ad. What is it? Where's the punchline? What's going on? And then it was like, you know, kind of this slow motion feel good. And it was Detroit is back. It wasn't so much Chrysler is back, although Chrysler, you know, got its name in there. But here's this dying city that's sort of coming back. And that's, you know, we can feel good about that. Whether we like the fact that the companies got bailed out, or you support the bailout, or there would have been a lot of other ways that we could still have an auto industry without the big government motors bailout. I didn't, when I saw it, I thought, kind of strange, kind of interesting, okay. I wasn't feeling, yeah, come on, or how dare you? And it was just, didn't do it for me, kind of long and slow. Afterwards, when people started saying, you know, Karl Rove says, I didn't like it. The White said, oh, we liked it a lot. They created, I think, a
demagoguery of it?
No, but a more political message than was existing in it at the time.
See, I got to tell you something. I saw the ad, and when I saw it, I looked at it, it's like, this isn't Republican, it's not Democrat. It's not pro-labor or pro-management. It's not pro-car industry bailout. It was a solid, solid message. I think it was the type of feel-good message that we needed to do, that we needed to have out there, and quite frankly, politicizing it just contributes to the demagoguery and some of the rhetoric that it seems that the 24-hour news cycle is feeding off of. I thought it was a great commercial.
I think this British woman singer, MIA, maybe had the right answer to those who wanted to make politics. Flip them off.
Very, very astute observation. Very astute observation. Well, I want to touch on that. We're going to take a quick 2-minute break. When we come back, we're going to talk to some folks from Habitat for Humanity, a great organization doing great things. This is a group out of North Florida that are really doing fantastic work for people in need down in a state where there is a lot of need right now. So when we come back, we'll talk to some folks from Habitat for Humanity and tell me a story. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. And we're back here in Chili's Back Room, live in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us are a couple of friends of mine who I haven't seen. Kathy, I haven't seen you in a while. That's been fantastic. It has been a while. Always good to see you. But Kathy and Mary Ann Christensen are here for a conference that's going on. I guess all of the Habitat for Humanity organizations are here in town right now, all gathering, kind of comparing notes. But I got to tell you something. Habitat for Humanity has always been kind of dear to my heart. I've seen the good work that you guys have done, especially in my other home state of Florida. Now, you're out of Northeast Florida, correct? What's the organization called there in Northeast Florida?
Right, Justin. We're at Beaches Habitat for Humanity.
And what area do you cover?
It's really the North Florida area, so it's the Beaches area, Jacksonville Beach, primarily with Mayport and Atlantic Beach.
Okay. I guess the big question I have for you is how much more business? I guess if you guys are getting more business, that's not a good sign, but how much more business are you guys getting now, particularly in that area, as a result of the economy going down? Are you seeing a lot more requests for Habitat?
It really has maintained on a very stable basis, but we have been in the business a long time for really addressing substandard housing and providing affordable housing. So regardless of the economy, our mission is already there. So regardless of what's happening with the economy, we certainly have many people that are in need of this, whether or not the economy is good. It really caters to a certain group, a certain population.
Up to this date, how many people have you placed in Habitat for Humanity homes?
Right now in the Beaches area of Jacksonville, Florida, we have 240 homes that we've built. And so we're in the process of building probably 14 to 16 new homes each year. Plus, we're also launching neighborhood revitalization, which is minor home repairs, which is also addressing other areas, which really is also part of the economy
within
the current inventory.
Right. Now, the gathering up here for all of the Habitat for Humanity organizations, is it a matter of this is more of information gathering? Is there an advocacy education issue going on in the Hill where you might see some of the folks from the Florida delegation?
Right, Justin. That's exactly what it is. For all the affiliates in the country, this is our Habitat on the Hill.
Right.
So we come up here for the next few days, really take an opportunity to meet our legislators and go up on the Hill, especially on Thursday, and pay everyone a visit that we can get in the door and talk to you about our ministry.
Have you guys seen a steady increase or a standard decline as a result of the economy? Are you guys still seeing contributions coming in on a steady basis?
Absolutely. One thing about development and fundraising for Habitat is that people really understand our program as a hand up and not a handout. So we have homeowners that are out there, they're building the home, 300 to 400 hours of sweat equity goes into their house. And so that's the kind of program that people like to really contribute and donate to.
You guys obviously have a lot of corporate support. You guys are getting a lot of political support, obviously. And then obviously when you say Habitat for Humanity, everybody talks about former President Jimmy Carter. First of all, has President Carter been down in your neck of the woods building a home, pounding nails?
He has. It's been probably now over 10 years when he came, but he did come and work with Habajax, which is the Jacksonville affiliate. And so he came down and visited them and built in the city.
How united are the Habitat for Humanity organizations? You know, usually when you talk about these individual clusters of individual charity units, there's always infighting, et cetera, but we don't seem to see that at Habitat for Humanity. How close of a structure is the global Habitat?
Very close. In the United States alone, there are 1,600 Habitat affiliates. And even though we're all separate affiliates, we have that one umbrella, and that's to provide affordable housing for those people in need and doing God's work. So really, it really has the same shared purpose with a great positive outcome. It puts people in homes.
Do you guys work a lot with Housing and Urban Development, the department here federally?
Not a lot. There is some partnership in that way, but our efforts are really primarily to seek private donations, to partner with corporations, to also work with churches in our communities to really do it.
So this isn't government subsidy. You're basically going off the generosity of industry and private
donors.
That's
usually our purpose. I mean, there are some grants that we do go out and seek, and that's really affiliate by affiliate, so it's hard to speak for every affiliate.
Now, if somebody wants to donate either time, support, money, money's always welcome, I guess, at Habitat for Humanity. If they want to give to the Beaches organization, how do they do that? Is there a website?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. You can go to beacheshabitat.org, and you can donate online. Our phone number is 904-241-1222. So there are lots of ways to reach us, and we just really, really thank you for the opportunity.
So habitatbeaches.com.
Beacheshabitat.
Beacheshabitat.com. .org. Beacheshabitat.org. And then the national organization, because I guess somebody in San Diego is probably going to go, well, I'm not really attached to somebody listed in San Diego. Is there a national website?
They can go to habitat.org.
Habitat.org.
Yeah, that's Habitat for Humanity International.
That's fantastic.
But we really do appreciate, I mean, North Florida is a great place to come, so come support
well,
us.
Well, I was stationed there for the Coast Guard in Jacksonville. I went to JU. Spent a lot of time. Well, JU was one of the five colleges I went to, but... So Jacksonville Central Beaches Space Coast, that's home for me. And I got to tell you something. You guys do amazing work. You guys do great things. And I'm sure that the people of Eastern Duval County really appreciate all you guys are doing. You guys do fantastic work. Marianne, Kathy, it is so good to see you guys. I'm glad you guys were able to stop in.
Thank you.
You guys are always welcome. If you guys have new developments down there, if something big is happening, feel free to call us and we'll get the word out, because we can always use more people like you guys and more organizations like Habitat for Humanity. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you. Little did we know how exciting this would be today. Yeah.
And by the way, you guys can play the archive when you get back to Florida and show everybody, holy crap, we were on the air. That's awesome. Probably not in that pitch, though. When we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's tell me a story. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics Live. From Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Habitat for Humanity, love that group, love that organization. And then Kathy's a good friend of mine, so it's always good to see them. This is my favorite part of the show. This is Tell Me a Story. So, with 4 minutes left, we should be able to knock this out fairly quickly. Bob, tell me a story.
Super Tuesday is Newt's last chance. Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Texas are all on the calendar for that day.
What does Newt pull out of that?
Well, the question is, those are his last chance. If he doesn't win, more delegates there than he has than he does total in that day than Romney does. He is totally dead. He's got to do very well, and I don't think it's possible given his lack of boots on the ground.
Interesting. Alan, tell me a story.
Well, I'm thinking about Newt also. I mean, here's this. Here,
all the good stories seem to be about news.
Here's this. Here's
or
this,
the bad stories.
Here's this guy.
No, but those are good stories.
Here's this guy that disappeared. And then he came crawling back and out of almost like out of a cave or something. And he and it's not clear exactly what his early objective was. But here's a guy who thinks very highly of himself, big ego, etc. And he thinks, apparently been thinking about being president for a long time. So he has a third-rate campaign organization. We've talked about that. Mm-hmm. We know that. And he had some first-rate debate performances.
Early on,
that gave him, I would say, false hopes, and he soared to the front. You know, after the flameouts of the Bachmans, the Perrys, the Keynes, and then he became, unfortunately, a big believer in himself, and now what he's got is still a third-rate organization. He's no longer a first-rate debater. He's an angry person. He's now got first-rate anger and a first-rate negativity and a first-rate kind of vendetta against Romney. He runs around talking about dishonest this and dishonest that and threats. He is at risk of destroying his hopes for the future. I don't think he's going to prevail at all. The question is, he's now that he resurrected himself, is he going to become an elder statesman of the party, which he could be? He's a smart guy.
A la Huckabee.
Yeah, well, even better than Huckabee. I wouldn't use Huckabee as the example. I mean, because he's a lot more creative. Huckabee's a nice guy. Newt isn't. But Newt's smarter. Newt's creative. He's a very thoughtful guy. He could be out there promoting ideas. He needs to contain his anger, but between now and Super Tuesday, if he wants to be an elder statesman and be listened to, or if he doesn't contain himself, he will be an afterthought and an angry old man. I think we're going to see a calmer guy because he is a smart guy in a lot of ways,
right?
Even with the massive ego.
Wow.
We'll see.
Very good. Might as well go for the hat trick on Newt. Newt's comments in Florida regarding the moon base did two things. One, created a great Saturday Night Live skit.
Yes.
But what it did do is bring up something that's very near and dear to my heart, but has now come back on the Republican national profile, and that is the space program and creating a healthy, robust space program in NASA. We're going to see the space program as they travel through space towns like Houston, as they go through states like California, where there's large aerospace, Houston, Alabama, as we start seeing more and more of these tours through some of these big aerospace states, the space programs become more and more of an issue, and it's going to be a piece of ammo that they're going to use against Obama. Al, I hope you're having a good time. Ralph, we'll see you next week. John Freshman never came. We
good
miss
thing.
Him. We love him, but we know he's busy. On behalf of Bob Hines, Alan Moore, I'm your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell. I will be here along with the rest of the crew, except for Al. He'll still be on vacation. We'll be back here next Tuesday.
On Valentine's Day.
You guys do anything Ooh-hoo. Special?
Oh, I'm not talking about
it. Oh, okay, forget it then. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in our heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
The place to be.
We'll see you next week. Thanks a lot for joining us, folks. Bye-bye.